Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and my goal is to help members of the military community thrive in their civilian career. Today is episode number 364, Impossible Foods.
And I think when I first tried it, it was probably Impossible 1.0. But I was blown away by the fact that I personally thought I had been delivered the wrong order because I thought it was B. And that was a really like aha moment for me where I thought this company isn't just aspirational in its mission. They have a product that's going to enable them to achieve it longer term. So that really caught my attention. And I think that while impossible, to your point, not everyone thinks about it as technology. I think food technology is going to be one of the most important industries going forward. And mainly for a lot of the reasons Dan highlighted earlier about the environmental impact that our current food system and supply chain has on our planet.
When Carlson School of Management came to us with an offer for financial sponsorship, Steve and I were like kids in a candy store. We had the resources to do any interview we'd like. That's like a dream come true. So as I was thinking through who I wanted to reach out to, I started thinking about purpose. Purpose is something that comes up time and time again in my interviews. And I wanted to find a company that is purpose-driven, a company that is doing something pretty different than everyone else. And that is how I came across Impossible Foods. They are re-envisioning how we eat and are driven by a deep desire to help us take better care of our planet. Not only that, but they have become a massive sensation. According to LinkedIn, there are now over 500 employees at Impossible, and according to Crunchbase, they have raised over $1.2 billion. That's right, $1.2 billion in funding. That's the amount of money a villain in a James Bond movie would demand to avoid destroying the world. Here's what I love about today's interview. First of all, I'm joined by two incredible veterans with two incredible career paths getting to Impossible Foods. And so we talk about their career journeys. We talk about innovation and sales, two very different career paths and functional roles, as well as their perspective on what it's like to work at Impossible. While we do talk a lot about Impossible, we cover a lot of ground about general career advice as well. If you enjoy this episode, check out the show notes for this episode where I link to a few interviews I've done in the crypto space that seems to share the same purpose-driven culture that I felt in this interview. And of course, this interview was only made possible due to a financial sponsorship from the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. I want to share a little bit more about them. Whether you are transitioning to a civilian career or continuing military service, an MBA from Carlson at the University of Minnesota prepares you for a high-impact career in business. Carlson is committed to the veteran community and provides the benefits, experiential learning, and network to accelerate your career. In addition to a resident tuition waiver, all admitted full-time MBA candidates receive generous scholarships and stipends to cover expenses that may not be eligible for the GI Bill. To learn more, you can visit the show notes at beyondtheuniform.org for this episode, where you'll see a sponsorship section, or you can send an email to mba@umn.edu. That's MBA, like Masters of Business Administration, at UMN for University of Minnesota.edu. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Dan Green and Ryan Fisher of Impossible Foods. Well, joining me today in Half Moon Bay, California, and near San Jose, California, I have two guests today, and that is Ryan Fisher and Dan Green. Ryan and Dan, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Justin.
So I want to give listeners a background on both of you, and I'll say that we're dealing with Impossible Foods today, and that's where both of them are working currently. Dan works as the SVP of U.S. Sales and Growth, He started out at the Naval Academy and served over 10 years as a Navy fighter pilot and director of operations for multiple aviation units. He's served as chief revenue officer for a conversational artificial intelligence startup, and he served as an executive consultant with other early stage software companies. Prior to that, Dan spent 11 years overseeing large teams and revenue generating businesses units at Google and Twitter. And Ryan is the director of new product innovation. He served in the U.S. Army for over 4 years as an explosive ordnance disposal officer. And he's worked in global supply at both Apple and Uber. He holds an MBA for the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. So maybe we'll start with Ryan and then go to Dan. But I'd love to share a little bit more about what your first transition was like out of the military.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I transitioned out of the military, I actually was on terminal leave when I started business school at the University of Virginia. So my transition was from active duty service to academia. And one of the things that drove me to make that decision to pursue my MBA is that as an undergrad, I studied electrical engineering. And I knew probably the day I graduated, if not long before, that I was never going to practice engineering in my career. That being said, as I looked at my post-military career, I saw opportunities in finance and broader business that were of more interest to me, and I thought would be a great next step to kind of broaden my educational background and prepare me for a new career.
Awesome. I too was an electrical engineering major. The only difference I'd say is that probably day one on that career path, I'm like, there's no way I'm going to do this for a career. How about you, Dan?
Everybody had to take double E at the academy, and that was one of the worst classes I ever took. The first few months, I tracked pretty well, but then after that, I was lost. Transition out of the military. So, it's a long time ago now, but I started the MBA program at UCLA, which is a fully employed program, while I was still on active duty. I was on a more or less a shore tour in San Diego, so I was able to commute up to Los Angeles and do that. So I started that. About 6 months later, I went on terminal leave and transitioned out. I actually got a job working for a commercial aviation company at first. And this company had a lot of different aviation assets. One of the things they were interested in doing was pursuing government contracts around aviation. And that was, you know, government and aviation, or the military and aviation, was one thing I did know and understand. I certainly didn't know much about contracting or business in general. But I was able to get a job with them and continue school. And I did that for about a year, year and a half. And that was really interesting. I learned a lot about business, learned a lot about financial planning analysis and deal development, buying and selling airplanes and going after deals. So that was really fascinating, actually, while I was going to school. Eventually, they wanted me to move to their corporate headquarters, which was near, it was a small town near Chicago, and I didn't really want to move out of California. And so I transitioned into helping start an aviation company, which is actually going pretty well today. It's called Tactical Air Support, and it's designed to provide piloted tactical aircraft to the military for training. So essentially bad guy services to the military. And so I transitioned to starting that company with a few other folks that I worked for when I was in the military, did that for about a year. There's kind of some overlap, and eventually made the natural, inevitable transition from that to Google. That's just a whole nother story.
And I'm just cognizant of time. There's so much for each of you we could go in, because you both have such incredible career paths, but also I respect that what you have done since the military, except, you know, Dan, for that initial one, what you've done since the military doesn't have a ton of overlap with what you did in the military, which I think is helpful for listeners. But I want to fast forward a little bit to Impossible Foods. And for listeners, just some background here. We got a sponsorship, financial sponsorship from Carlson School of Management to do whatever interviews we wanted. And Impossible Foods came to mind for me. And so this may seem like a salesy interview for Impossible Foods, but it's more of like my own fan love for this company. And the reason why I wanted to highlight this is as I step back, there's a phrase at business school called BHAG, or Big Hairy Audacious Goal. I come from a background in Silicon Valley of seeing a lot of sameness. People are doing kind of the same thing. And Impossible Foods is one of the few companies I look at where I'm like, man, that is seriously off-roading. Not only is it something that very few people on earth are attacking, but it's something that, you know, in my view, has the potential to change the world. And so maybe to start, Dan, could you share with us, for people who are unfamiliar, what is Impossible Foods? What do you all do as a company?
We make really incredible meat from plants. And our goal, as you pointed out, is to replace animals in the food chain by 2035. So the basic idea that Pat Brown, our founder, had going back eight, 9 years ago when he took a sabbatical from Stanford was, what are some of the biggest problems the world's facing right now, and how can I help solve them? And clearly the environment and the impact that we've had on the environment is a serious problem. And as he dove into that particular problem, he found that animal food production was one of the biggest impacts on the environment itself. And he thought about it for a while, and he realized that, you know, veggie patties and veggie burgers have been out for quite a while and hadn't necessarily influenced or impacted things beyond making vegans and vegetarians happy. And he realized that in order to really solve this problem, he was going to have to figure out how to make meat from plants in a way that was environmentally safe and sound and nutritious and so on and so forth. Spent a long time researching, a long time developing product, and eventually about 3 or 4 years ago, we launched our first commercial product, which is essentially ground beef made from plants. It's first and foremost, it tastes incredibly good. It's and that's the whole idea. It is when you look at it, when you feel it, when you cook with it, when you eat it, you feel like you are eating ground beef from a cow, but it's not. It's from plants. It's better for you. And it's astronomically better for the environment. And this dovetails nicely into sort of what Pat was ultimately trying to do, in that if you can create a product that has a minimal impact on the environment, that is fundamentally healthy for humans to eat, that satisfies their cravings for meat in a way that they don't feel like they're sacrificing anything when they eat it, you can harness the power of the market to really change the world. And that's what we're doing.
And I remember a distinct conversation I had in my first year at business school. So this is 11 or 12 years ago, where someone, I think what he said to me is, hey, did you know that one of the largest emissions of greenhouse gases come from cows, from the methane that they emit? And I may be botching that, but it kind of blew my mind at the time. Could you connect the dots a little bit for listeners? Like, what is the environmental impact of eating meat?
I think some of the interesting stats that help crystallize this, roughly 40% of arable land is devoted to animal agriculture and raising animals for food, 40%. And that is, when you do that, you clear farmland and you clear brush and you clear trees, forest land and trees and brush and so on and so forth, to create pastures for either raising crops for animals or ultimately raising animals themselves. And as you do that, you have a significant impact on biodiversity, on watershed, and ultimately on carbon capture and oxygen creation. And these are all things that ultimately contribute to greenhouse gases and environmental warming, right? I think the other day Pat was talking about this, and said something like, if you just simply reclaimed all that land, you could essentially stop or reverse the effects of global warming by allowing nature to essentially reclaim and grow what was originally there. So this has a pretty significant impact. I think the other things just to help crystallize the size and scope of the problem, something like I think the biomass of all cows on the planet is 10 times greater than the biomass of all remaining wild animals, which has decreased by like half over the course of the last 40 years. So we're having a significant impact on biodiversity, on and on both carbon capture and oxygen generation. And all of these things are contributing to global warming and a detrimental impact on the environment. The last little stat that I'll throw out, I think roughly 1% of farmland is devoted to soy right now. That soy crop, as it exists right now, goes to feed people and to feed animals. That soy crop alone, that little 1%, is enough protein, if used properly, to feed 1.5 times the Earth's population. So you can generate enough protein in 1% of farmland to feed 1 to 2 times the current population of the planet if you do it properly. It's not going to work just by creating tofu or black bean burgers, but it can work if you can create really incredibly good meat made from plants.
And Ryan, I'm curious about your experience is you know, if you were recording this at a time when everyone's working remotely, but when you were in the office, if you were to like pull out a McDonald's hamburger, are you going to get like people showing the crucifix to you? Like, what is the culture like around people eating meat at all?
Yeah, so it's a good question. There, you know, what Dan mentioned is we're looking to appeal to meat eaters. The Impossible Burger has drawn both vegetarians and meat eaters alike to work at the company. So you see both of it. Now you know, the culture within the company is there certainly is quite a bit of plant-based eating, but we understand that people enjoy meat. And again, we're creating a product that we hope to be able to replace that and satisfy that same craving. Mm.
And I'm trying to think of the Netflix documentary I watched. I think it was Game Changers. Is that
Game Changers.
Yeah. For listeners, I'll kind of bookmark that I'm not vegetarian by any extent, but I really appreciated this documentary called Game Changers. That's a very high performance athlete who explores all the incredible athletes who do a plant-based diet and the increases they've seen in performance. And for me, it kind of went against the my understanding of thinking like, oh, you have to eat a ton of meat in order to be healthy. And it's worth checking out if you're curious about that. I'd love to start with you, Ryan, and then go to you, Dan, to set stage for the rest of our conversation. Ryan, share a little with listeners a little bit more about your role, especially for someone who's on active duty. I said you're the director of new product innovation, which I find interesting because it's a company that seems like it's producing new products anyways. What do you do? What does that translate to on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so I am the new product introduction director, and my role is heavily focused on program management in terms of execution of development of new products and the supply chain and operations preparations and readiness to be able to launch those products into market. So on a day-to-day basis, the new product introduction team that I lead is partnering with everyone from product innovation scientists to folks on the product development side, to operations and supply chain, and then also marketing and sales. So working with the members of Dan's team and understanding what is the market that we're trying to address. What does that mean in terms of us preparing to launch a product into that market? So it's a very cross-functional role. You know, one of the things that I think coming out of the military, I've always looked for roles in which problem solving and cross-functional collaboration were kind of a key part of the role. I think that's a unique skill set that military veterans bring to the table. We are, you know, or we were challenged on a daily basis with new problems to solve and often with new groups of people with which we needed to work to solve them. So I think that as I look at my role today, really the nuts and bolts of the role is problem solving, coming up with creative solutions, and steering a cross-functional team to a unified goal, which is ultimately introducing new products into the market.
I love it. And for listeners, I want to tag how beautifully Ryan explained his role and kind of tied it back into the military. And I think a lot of hiring managers might not look at a veteran and say, like, problem solving and collaboration, those might not be two attributes they associate with veterans. And I think that's very, very relevant for most people in the military. And so I love how he kind of connected the dots to say, oh, this is essentially strengths that I developed in the military, and it's what I'm doing here. That's such a great way to spoon feed a hiring manager to show them how your background is relevant to that role.
Absolutely.
How about you, Dan? You're the SVP of US sales and growth. What does that look like? What does that mean?
So I lead a set of teams that are focused on helping to drive revenue by taking our products to market. In order for Impossible Foods to accomplish its mission, we need to be able to continuously develop the world's greatest plant-based meats and plant-based foods. And in order to do that, we need money to hire scientists and engineers and product managers and build productive capability and so on and so forth. That money comes from sales or investment. As a startup, we get our money from investment as well, but on an increasing basis, we will self-fund our growth through selling our products. And that's what our team does. So our team goes to market, works with, we sell our products to restaurants, restaurant companies like Burger King and Starbucks, who we, you know, Burger King we launched about a year ago, recently we just launched a new product with them, the Impossible Croissant Sandwich, which is a breakfast sandwich, really, really good, made with the Impossible Sausage. And then Starbucks just launched a few weeks ago as well with their Impossible Breakfast Sandwich, which is awesome. So we sell into and work with partners like Starbucks and Burger King, as well as smaller chains, like smaller national chains, Cheesecake Factory and Red Robin, but also smaller regional and mom and pop operations as well. And then we also have a ever growing retail or grocery business that we sell into. So we launched in retail back in September of 2019. So just about a year ago, we started with just about with three different retail brands: Wegmans on the East Coast, and Gelson's in Southern California, and Fairway in New York. About 142 stores, which is a very small number of grocery stores, and got our product into market. Understood how it was, how the public was, our consumers were reacting to it. Built up our productive capacity over the course of the subsequent 3 to 6 months, and then starting in April, we've begun to roll out a national footprint in grocery. And now we're at we closed out Q2 with over 5,000 stores. By the end of the year, we'll probably be in something like 20,000.
That was interesting for me when I first started to learn about Impossible was, it seems like your strategy as a company was to go directly to restaurants or businesses and then expand to consumer. And I'm just curious if that's accurate or what was kind of leading that. Because in my mind, I thought, oh, it's going to start out in the grocery store, which seems like it came later for you as a company.
Yeah, and there's different ways you can go to market with a product like this. Ultimately, the product that we launched with, Impossible 1.0, worked really well with restaurants. In fact, worked well with a chef who understood how to cook it. It didn't work as well in things like chili or, you know, pasta sauce. It was a slightly different formulation, but it came out really, really well when you made it into a, if you made it into a meatball or you made it into a burger. And we wanted to sort of get the early adopters, the culinary world to take on this product and cook it in really amazing ways. And so we went into sort of like high-end restaurants first, sort of gastro pubs and the like. And that's where we launched. That was where we grew the business initially from a commercial point of view. At the start of 2019, we introduced at CES the newer version of our product, which I think cooks like ground beef in every way and can hold up in just about any recipe. And that product is, I think, universally applicable to the restaurant business, but also easily packaged for retail and for consumer preparation. And so that sort of explains how we went from, you know, starting with the restaurant business, getting into more broad distribution of the restaurant business and ultimately into retail near the end of 2019 with that's the second version of our product. The interesting thing, a couple of interesting points. One is our product continuously evolves and develops and gets better. Not, you know, cows tend not to, right? They're pretty much steady state at this point. So, you know, the good news is our competition isn't really innovating, but we are. And we're on the second version of our product. We just released Impossible Pork and Impossible Sausage at the beginning of this year. We will release new products over the course of this year and next and so on and so forth. You can easily imagine that our core product, ground beef, will get better and better. And that's, I think, one of the interesting things about using technology to develop food. We can innovate.
That leads in. That's actually interesting you said that, because one of the things I'd love to ask of both of you, and we'll start with Ryan, but this is a show about essentially career transitions and the one that we all share from the military to not in the military. But from an external standpoint, one thing that I thought was interesting about both of your backgrounds is you've got Twitter and Google and Uber and some of the companies I most associate with technology. And then you have Impossible Foods, which I didn't view as a technology until you just said that right now, Dan. But Ryan, starting with you, I'd love to learn about what drew you to Impossible Foods and what that transition was like, going from hardcore tech companies to something that was, that seems to me is to be pretty different.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think the first thing that drew me to Impossible was the mission. And, you know, I think that one thing you'll find in common across the folks who are employed by Impossible is a passion for that mission to replace animal products in our food supply chain. So that was number one for me. And what was even more compelling is not just that the company had a mission, but when I first tried the product, and I think when I first tried it, it was probably Impossible 1.0, but I was blown away by the fact that I personally thought I had been delivered the wrong order because I thought it was beef. And that was a really like aha moment for me, where I thought this company isn't just aspirational in its mission. They have a product that's going to enable them to achieve it longer term. So that really caught my attention. And I think that while Impossible, to your point, not everyone thinks about it as technology, I think food technology is going to be one of the most important industries going forward. And mainly for a lot of the reasons Dan highlighted earlier about the environmental impact that our current food system and supply chain has on our planet. So for me, there was a mission, there was an exciting product, and while the company has been around for many years now, there was a significant amount of momentum building in terms of product getting out to the market, awareness around the product. And for me, it was something, it was an opportunity for me to take my career path in a direction where I'd be more focused on building teams, building processes, and helping the company to grow. Not to say in my past career I didn't experience growth with Apple, but it was a whole different experience. And again, the mission based drive for me was really strong with Impossible. So it was very motivating to make the switch. And again, while food tech is not the same as hardware tech, I think the problem solving approach that we take at Impossible looks very much like the tech environment that I've seen in the past and other roles that I've held within Silicon Valley.
That's great. Thank you, Ryan. How about you, Dan?
Yeah, I think the core question is sort of how I ended up sort of at Impossible and how it relates back to tech, and it very much the same as what Ryan said. Ultimately, I mean, Impossible Foods is a tech company and a food company, right? It's we're a tech company that produces food. We operate, we think and operate like a tech company. We manage the business like a tech company. We happen to make, instead of hardware, we make or software, we make food, really, really good food, and so that is different. And we have to understand the food ecosystem and how restaurants and the restaurant marketplace works and how grocery and retail works and, you know, how to make a perishable product versus, you know, iPhones tend to be not to perish unless you throw them, you know, deep into the ocean. You know, like I think there are definitely some differences, but, you know, the basic blocking and tackling is very, very similar to tech. And so there, it is closely related, and it's not a foreign environment, but ultimately, so that's one element, that explains how I ended up here. I think the other one is I was looking for a product and a business. You know, I was at Google for a while. I was at Twitter for a while. Great companies, awesome experiences, learned a lot, and jumped into the startup world. Spent a couple of years at a couple of different startups and consulting for a few, and came out of that 2 year period thinking, okay, I really want to find a company that is in a business and has a product that I find to be truly interesting and compelling and passionate about. I didn't actually think that I would find something that was on a mission that would truly motivate me. Every company has a mission. Every tech company has a mission. Google's mission is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful to everybody. That's cool. That's fun. It's really interesting. It's really important. It's not about saving the planet. There are very few commercial companies that are trying to genuinely, authentically save the planet and create a viable commercial enterprise at the same time. Impossible Foods sits in a rarefied air in that space, in that way. And so when I happened upon Impossible, I thought, okay, here's a tech company, really cool product that I'm motivated and interested in. And then on top of that, this amazing mission that is truly inspiring. The last time I had a mission like that was when I was in the military. And, you know, in the military, you're not motivated by money. You're motivated by a mission to help protect our country and our way of life and ultimately, to be a part of contributing to the greater good. And you don't get as much of that in business. We get it in spades, at Impossible, which is really motivating.
I mean, I'm so glad you said that. I think that's one of the things behind when I reached out is realizing, I think something, you know, this is the 360 something episode I've done, but a shared value most veterans have is a desire for purpose, a desire for mission. And there's often a sense of flailing when one leaves the military of finding that. And again, this is just my personal opinion. There's not a lot of companies I see like that. And, you know, Tesla comes to mind, SpaceX, and a lot of the people from cryptocurrency, surprisingly, that I interviewed on the show, they seem like their motivation, the impetus for them joining that company is purpose. But I put you as a company in that category of not only an incredible business opportunity, but it seems like a foundational purpose and mission driving the team members.
Yeah, I think everybody here is driven by that mission from Pat on down, and it is the most important thing that we're doing. In fact, Pat says this fairly often that, like, hey, look, you know, we've got this strategy, we've got this technology, we've got this product and or products that we're developing. But if you've got a better product and a better idea, we'll come work for you. Ultimately, our objective is to help save the planet. And Pat, I don't think Pat's terribly interested in making a lot of money. I really don't think he cares about it. Maybe he does, but you know, like that's typically not the case with most CEOs, right? And most executives, like he's not terribly interested in making a lot of money, but he's really not terribly interested in building the world's, you know, biggest company, greatest brand, or being on the front cover of Time Magazine. He's really interested in having a profound impact on the future of our planet. That's what he cares about. And that's what he wants all of us to care about. That's what he wants Impossible to do.
That's great. Another thing I wanted to ask, and we'll start again with you, Ryan, and then Dan, is both of you in different ways pursued an MBA. And I'm curious for people listening who are interested in this industry and for both the industry, but also for your specific functional roles of innovation and sales, What advice do you have about an MBA? Is that essential now? Has that been advantageous? Is it not necessary? How would you advise listeners to consider that if they're interested in either Impossible Foods, your industry, or your functional role?
Yeah, so you know, I think it's a very personal decision, the MBA versus direct to industry decision. For me personally, I found it to be the 2 years that I spent at the University of Virginia, I found to be extremely valuable to giving me kind of the foundation within business that I thought I needed to be successful. And I do think it's helped me along the way. I actually went into grad school thinking I would pursue a career in finance. And I spent my summer internship at Morgan Stanley and their investment banking group. Had a great time, but didn't know if it was the long kind of the long-term career fit for me, and ended up pursuing an opportunity at Apple. But you know, during my time at Apple, I had an employee who came directly from the service, was a Navy veteran, flew F-18s in the Navy, and he was outstanding. He hit the ground running. He was a global supply manager on my team. Went and worked at in marketing, and then decided to go back and get his MBA. So you know, so I think the path is different for different people. But again, I personally found value in pursuing my MBA first. But I've seen people be extremely successful without taking that path.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think you can go either direction. It probably depends a lot on the particulars in your own situation. I think an MBA can give you a really good basis for moving forward. I think ultimately, unfortunately, there's no, you know, you, in the military, let's say you finish one tour and you're thinking about what your options are. You've got these five options, maybe 10, maybe three, but it's finite. And in the civilian world, it's infinite. There's no absolute path. And the same can be said for, the CEO of Facebook, Apple, former CEO of Apple, and former CEO and founder of Microsoft didn't even have college degrees. Now that's an exception. I'm not advocating for people not to get college degrees. I think they should. But ultimately, there's just not a surefire playbook on what you should do. I talked to vets who are or active duty service members and recent vets who are all sort of like just transitioning into the civilian world pretty often, once every few weeks, and I often recommend getting an MBA as a good way to start because of all the reasons that Ryan highlighted. It does give you time to understand and learn about the business world and what's out there and what the ecosystem really looks like. I think ultimately when you get an MBA, there are three things that you're getting. You're getting an education. The education is important. You can get the same education with the high-speed wireless internet connection and the library card, but like it's organized really well when you go get an MBA. So I think it's helpful. You get a network. It's not the network that most people think about. I don't think I don't think somebody who went to Darden 20 years ago really cares about Ryan, not like the military network takes care of its own. It's not that network. It's the people that we went to school with, just like the people you work with, right? So the people that you go to school with at Darden or at UCLA or whatever, those folks, that's a good network, and it's a supportive network. And you get that when you go get an MBA. And then the third thing is you get a stamp on your resume. And right or wrong, it's probably, in my opinion, the stamp that's more valuable than anything else. The stamp opens some doors. It gives you a little bit of credibility. It gives you some insurance, and it probably shouldn't, but it does. And so having that stamp in your resume can help you can help do some of those things. Can help you get the right interviews, or can help you get into, you know, it can help you generate interest from the right companies and so on and so forth.
And one thing I wanted to ask you, Dan, is one thing that continues to surprise me is it seems like the military community has a negative view on sales. Like the number of veterans that I talk with who are like, you know, oh, I don't want to be salesy, or I don't like sales. And it surprises me because I think that many of the attributes we develop in the military make for being exceptional salespeople. And you've had an extremely successful and varied career revolving around sales and revenue generation and growth. What advice do you have for listeners about considering that as a career path?
I think whether you're in the military or you're a college kid, or even in high school, and you mentioned sales, people think about selling at the Gap or at the BMW dealership or something like that. And those are all actually really good jobs and incredibly important. But that's not business to business sales. Business to business sales is different. What people don't understand, I think, is a fundamental truth. Businesses do, all businesses, except for a couple, essentially do the same thing. You make stuff and you sell stuff. That's what businesses do, right? You make some stuff and then you sell it. And that means that the vast majority of people working in a company and in business at large are either the makers of things or the sellers of things. And it can be directly or indirectly making or directly or indirectly selling, but ultimately that's the majority of where people are. And if you think about business careers and you think about opportunities and opportunities for leading large teams and so on and so forth, senior leadership opportunities and things like that, the majority of opportunities are going to come from the makers of things or the selling of things. Your ability, like the opportunities to lead teams and lead large teams, to lead large chunks of a business, are going to filter up through the makers or the sellers. And if you want to be in those main elements and have those kinds of opportunities, you have to choose whether you want to get into the making or the selling. You don't have to be in those in those functions. There are plenty of other functions that are incredibly important, like finance or HR or legal, but you need to understand the fundamental truth of business. So I think when it comes to understanding what kinds of career opportunities are available to folks coming out of the military, or how they should be thinking about it, they should be thinking, I think, in turn, they should understand that fundamental ecosystem and spend time talking to people that are selling and spend time talking to people that are making to get a better handle on exactly what those worlds look like in business. And it's going to be fundamentally different than anything you really could think of before you get into it.
That's great. And Ryan, you being more on the making side of the equation, what advice do you have for listeners who might be interested in a similar career path at all, loosely dub around innovation?
Yeah. So, you know, I think that it goes back to the challenge of leading and bringing together a cross-functional team. I mean, at the end of the day, and I say this probably almost every day in discussions with both folks within and external to Impossible, program management is really about being able to align different stakeholders who may have competing priorities and a focus on a singular goal. And again, I think that as we look at veterans, it just translates so well when you think about the challenge of focusing on a singular mission and driving all of the different pieces of the team to that end state and to that goal. So my advice would be, more than anything, have confidence in the experience that you gain in the military and leverage that and find a way to communicate how that experience, how the leadership opportunities, enlisted officer or otherwise, the leadership is there with veterans. And I think communicating it effectively as you pursue a new career is critical, and that confidence is going to be critical. But, you know, again, more specific to the new product introduction role, there's a breadth of different roles that kind of touch in this program management space, whether it's on an operations side or on an engineering side. And I think that the thing that I would say is there's, you know, look at the different options out there and see what seems to fit your interests best. For me, I entered program management through an operations role. I was a global supply manager, and I wanted to do something a little bit more cross-functional. So I led a team of operations program managers. And now that I'm at Impossible, it's a little bit broader. I'm leading new product introduction program managers who are working on the development side as well as on the operational side. So again, I think leveraging leadership, leveraging that concept of working with a cross-functional and diverse team is something that a lot of veterans bring and can use to kind of open some doors in new product introduction and in program management more broadly.
That's great. And then starting with Dan and then Ryan, one thing I think that's interesting about each of you, and again, there's some stereotypes I'll dive through, but you know, we've got a pilot, we've got EOD. This is a little bit more on the alpha realm of the military, which is an alpha group. And it's the military in general, I think we have a connotation of meat eaters. You know, this is like who we are. We love our red meat. What, if you were having a beer with someone on active duty and you were pitching them on either joining Impossible Foods as a team member or just trying the product, how do you give that pitch to someone who's very likely, you know, burger and steak in their blood?
Well, I'd say, how we pitch it to a business is one thing. How I might convince them, an individual might be slightly different. Something to the extent of like, look, we're doing the same thing a cow does. A cow's a super inefficient factory. A cow takes plant matter, consumes it, turns it into protein matter, animal protein. And then we happen to kill that cow, slaughter it, process it, and make it into meat. We just take the cow out of the equation, right? We're taking plant matter and we're creating meat. So we just don't have to put it through a living organism to do it, at least an animal organism to do it. And you know, we've taken we've broken meat down at a molecular level to understand proteins and fats and nutrients and taste and flavor profiles, and recreated that with natural ingredients, really five basic natural ingredients, which is textured soy protein, a little bit of potato protein, sunflower oil and coconut oil for fat, and then a product called heme, leg hemoglobin, which is in every living organism from plants to animals. And that's what helps us catalyze the flavor. It's what helps us transform the product in the cooking process. It's what makes the fundamental difference between our product and many other products. And ultimately what we've created is meat. It's just made from directly from plants instead of taking the plants, putting it through a cow and then getting the meat out of it. So why not try it?
I love, I'm such an efficiency junkie, and I love the thought of just eliminating an unnecessary middleman and the efficiency there. Ryan, anything you'd add or vary on that?
Yeah, so I think one of the most fun ways to convince people of kind of our product and our mission is to serve them Impossible without them knowing that it's impossible.
Yeah.
And yes. I love the look on people's faces when they find out that they're eating a plant-based burger. Most people are shocked, but delighted, because it is such a delicious product. So I think, again, when I think about the importance of product and that in accomplishing our mission, I think that's the number one selling point for me. If I'm talking to a friend or a colleague or someone else, is having them try the product, and ideally unknowingly. So I think that's that's number one. And then, you know, the other thing is, I said this before, but I think the challenges of that are existing or existent in our food supply chain today are some of the biggest that we're going to have to solve in the coming years. So for me, it's about being part of something that's much bigger than myself and contributing to a mission that hopefully will have a very long and lasting impact beyond my time at Impossible.
That's great. Well, I always like to leave the last question open-ended, and we'll start with Dan and then go to Ryan. You have an audience of 50% people who are on active duty, 50% people who transition from the military but are just thinking of how to further their career. And I'm just cognizant of how impressive each of you have as backgrounds and how limited my questions were. So I just want to give you each space to have some final words of wisdom for our audience about maximizing their career out of uniform.
I think that it's a good question. So, you know, Ryan hit on this a little bit before. There are plenty of transferable skills that we develop in the military that translate into the business world. It won't always translate directly, and it won't always translate immediately, but you've developed abilities to solve problems, You've developed abilities to work in dynamic and stressful environments and focus on objectives and missions and achieve them. You develop the ability to work closely with other people and collaborate deeply with other people and work as a cohesive team. And these are soft skills, in some cases hard skills, that are hard to come by and incredibly valuable. And then in, I think, almost every case, whether you're a prior enlisted or prior officer, you have had direct leadership experience managing a team and managing individuals. And all of the that leadership experience, it needs to be translated a little bit. There's some subtleties and some differences as to how you lead in the civilian world versus the military. But the fundamental premise of know and understand your people, develop trust through technical competency and showing that you care, and take care of your team and they'll take care of the business. That fundamental leadership philosophy works in the civilian world as well as it works in the military. And so there's a lot of parallels and there's a lot of similarities. What you need to do is figure out what you want to do. And the way to figure out what you want to do is to talk to as many people as possible and network with as many people as possible. And the good news is the tech industry has created the perfect tool for it. It's called LinkedIn. And you should check it out if you haven't checked it out already. But LinkedIn is an incredibly valuable resource, and you need to network with as many folks as possible to build as many connections, have as many informational conversations as you can. I would definitely leverage every veteran you can find in whatever industry you're interested in, and connect with those individuals and set up calls and have informational discussions and be prepared, be ready to talk, be prepared with a set of questions that you have for that person and understand who they are, what they've done, and what information you want to get out of them. But build that picture of this is what's out there and this is what's going on, both from an industry point of view and from functional roles, and so that you can get clarity on exactly what it is you want to do, and then get back into networking to work your way into the right role based on what you've figured out you want to do. Going back to the first point I made, you know, with all the skills you developed in the military, you may not be able to go right into the perfect role, but you can get yourself into the right direction, right? Oh, okay. I know why I want to work at a tech company, and I know I want to get into the selling of things. And turns out the sales operations team is hiring, and that's a good start. And then I can work my way into sales roles or the opposite, and get into the production side. But the point is, ultimately, network as much as you can to build a clear picture of what's out there, figure out what it is you want to do, and then leverage that network to get yourself going in the right direction.
That's great. 100% agree with that. The conversations, leveraging those connections, building up that network. That's perfect. How about you, Ryan?
Yeah, so I'm going to echo the network comments. And Dan mentioned this earlier, but I think the network and the connection that veterans feel is, in my experience, stronger than any other network that I've built or been a part of in my career or prior to my professional career. So it's a very strong network. When I see a message from a veteran on LinkedIn that I've never met before, I'm going to respond to that before perhaps other messages in my queue. There's a connection and a responsibility I feel to helping other veterans. So I think that's extremely important. And over time, Silicon Valley has become quite a hub. If we look at the technology space and other companies out here in the Bay Area, has become quite a hub for veterans networks. Dan and I share common acquaintances that have worked at Google and at Apple and at Facebook. And so that network is growing. And it's fluid. People move from company to company. So there's a lot of mixing. And again, it fosters just a better connected overall veterans network in this area. So first and foremost, I would say leverage that network. And the other thing is, again, this is echoing what was just said, but that discovery piece is so important. I remember when I used business school to kind of figure things out. Those were my 2 years to figure out what was out there and what I wanted to do. But not everyone's going to take that path. So use the network to have discovery conversations in a more comfortable setting with someone who shares a common background as a veteran, You know, before talking to a recruiter or before applying to a specific job, I could not, you know, I thought I wanted to do finance when I entered my MBA program, but I could not tell you why. So I think those discovery conversations that veterans will be willing to have with someone who's looking for a new career path are so critical. So I can't stress that point enough. And then, you know, what I would say is for those who are out of the military and in the workforce, build that, you know, continue to build that same network and give it back to the veterans who are following. I think that's, you know, I've been the benefactor of veterans networks that were built long before my arrival at Apple. You know, it's something that I think is so important to kind of continue that momentum and continue to support future veterans.
Just add a quick anecdote. I totally agree with what Ryan said, that the veteran connection is strong. And we have a tendency as a community to help each other first and foremost, which I think is important. It's important for veterans who are in a position to help to do so. It's important for veterans who need help to reach out. I got my job at Google because of a fellow veteran that was there. So my start in the industry, in the tech industry was, I was trying to figure out where I wanted to work and I had criteria and so on and so forth as I was getting ready to the reason I didn't stay at this startup was because we weren't even paying ourselves salary. So my wife wanted me to go get a paycheck. So, Google popped up in my radar as having really great culture, really interesting company. I didn't know anything about tech. This is 2006. I knew about Google and everything, but I really wasn't looking to get into tech and tech sales. I had no idea what I was doing. But I reached out, did some research, and then ultimately reached out to a guy named Roy Gilbert, who is a Submariner, who was already at Google, one of the few veterans that was there. And he responded, even though he's in India, working in India, responded. We had a couple of phone calls, conversations, and I shot him some job recs and what I was interested in. He says, "That's all. You're not going to get any of those jobs here." Shot me a job rec. It was called Manager of Online Sales and Operations, which essentially it was essentially a one-page job rec that read exactly like a junior military officer's job. It's slightly different details, but everything else is the same. I think I can do that job. He's like, "Yep, I think you can." And he referred me in, and the only reason that I think I was ultimately even at the top of the pile to interview and everything else was because of that network and that support.
Roy and I connected when I was at business school, and it is amazing. As a testament to what you and Ryan have both said, it's amazing, even just taking one person to see all of the people he has helped and paid it forward to. And I think that's true. And I love, Ryan, your quote of realizing how strong this network is. So Ryan, Dan, thank you both so much. I can only imagine how busy each of you are, and to have both of you together on the show is really incredible, and appreciate your time and perspective today.
Thanks, Justin.
Beyond the Uniform is written and produced by me, Justin Nasiri, with help from our Chief of Staff, Steve Bain, and our editor, Kathleen Dillon. We are an all-volunteer organization and would greatly appreciate your help in any of the following ways. First, spread the word. Beyond the Uniform has over 330 podcast episodes and 15 on-demand webinars, all offered for free. Help us spread the word on social media, at military bases, or whatever gets this resource in front of more men and women who need it. Positive reviews on iTunes go a long way towards this as well. Second, sponsorship. Beyond the Uniform relies on sponsorship to keep us going. There is so much more we'd like to do, but we don't have nearly the resources to do so. If you know of a company that would like to advertise in any way with Beyond the Uniform, please send them to beyondtheuniform.org. Third, donations. If you're in a financial position to donate, you can find more information on the support section of beyondtheuniform.org. At our website, beyondtheuniform.org, you'll also find 330-plus episodes categorized by industry, functional role, and more. You'll find a link for live events, typically 4 per month. You'll also find both free and for-purchase books that take a deeper dive on topics related to career growth. Thank you for your support as we aim to help members of the military and their families thrive in their post-military career and life.